Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the February 16, 2015 edition of the Heretics Hour. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host, as usual, and I want to tell you that March 1st will be the fifth anniversary of this program, which has run continuously since March 1st, 2010. That was the very first program, and the very first program was about Elie Wiesel. And I had some new information for that show, which I was just anxious to do on my first radio program. And it was information that had been gathered together and published by Carlo Mattonio. And then I continued. I got so interested. I must have been interested before that. But I continued working assiduously in the field of Elie Wiesel. And I have taken a break from that, but you know, I did a little post on Elie Wiesel Cons the World, which is at EliWieselTattoo.com, www.EliWieselTattoo.com, just 2 days ago or so, because of his latest full page ad in the New York Times and Washington Post about Netanyahu's visit, urging the President and Vice President of the United States to join him there to listen to Netanyahu, because both of them have, well, I should say, planned other things for that day, because they are not going to be attending that. You're probably aware of some of the disputes going on there. I'm not going to go into that. But I started getting interested again in some of the old things I've written about, and I might, if I have time, I don't know how I have time, but I would like to return to that again, because I do believe that Elie Wiesel was definitely never an inmate at Buchenwald, and the evidence shows that, and there's a fantastic argument for that, which at least I'll do it on the radio one of these days coming up, remind everybody about this and go through this again. So I think it's also questionable that he was ever at Auschwitz too, which to me is huge, 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 but nobody seems to want to touch it except me. So I asked that question and comment there, and I might be bringing it up some more in the future. So anyway, on March 1st, that's 2 weeks from tonight, when that rolls around, that is worth celebrating, so I'm going to have to think of something special to do on that night. I've got 2 weeks to come up with it, so I'll see what I can do. But 5 years without a break continuously, not that I haven't had a few little breaks, but no more than the last one was the most 2 weeks at a time, but that was unusual, mostly just 1 week and not very often at all. So that's quite a milestone. And I want to say that I mentioned two other items before I get started that I think are important. One is the plight of Vincent Renoir, which should concern everybody who listens to this show and my other shows and reads my website. Vincent is still a free man, although under a court judgment of a 2-year prison term and huge fines to pay. That is huge fines to pay to the Jewish organizations that brought the lawsuit against him. And Vincent has put up a new internet page with instructions on how to send money. And you can find that at phdnm.org. Now, you'd think they would come up with a title for their web page, easier to remember and not get confused. But it is phdnm.org, and the N comes before the M. N as in Nancy and M as in Martin. And please do go there and support this fantastic man and his family. You know, it's always the best and most effective and the bravest who they go after. And we need to keep that in mind. They want us to be left with no leaders. They want to take the best and the bravest. And so we need to really fight in this instance, because Vincent says that he's going to fight all the way to the end. He's not going to cave in or quiet down because of this. He's just going to keep pushing, and he has a lot to live for. He has, you just don't, most of you, I think, are not aware of his total family situation. I shouldn't be saying anything about it, but it's criminal. He's one of the best men I know and have ever known, so I do hope that you will join me in helping Vincent out in this instance, and even, you know, his people close to him who need help too. On this website, we learned that he is, well, I learned from sending in from an email from Marie that he has been sacked from his two professor jobs. I guess he had two teaching jobs. She says professor, maybe it's tutoring that she means, but he was keeping things going by a couple of tutoring jobs. Well, he's been, or maybe they're professor jobs, I don't know what they are, but he's been let go from those, so there's no income, and he does say that on this new webpage. It's not a new website, but it's a new webpage he's put up. And I'll keep people informed as much as I can about Vincent Renoir in the coming time. We won't leave him. We won't forget about him. And many, many, many people are supportive of him. So we can be glad of that. And as I said, that they want us to be left with no leaders. And tonight's program topic is about leadership, because Adolf Hitler's Platterhof speech, which is not a speech but a talk, is foremost on the subject of leadership and how the Führer placed so much importance on that particular ability and trait. Before we get into that, there's one more item which also impinges on leadership, and that's the great news I saw shortly before showtime. I'm so happy to see it, and I didn't have time to really make notes about it, so I just copied down the first part of this news article, and I'm just going to read it. It's from Brussels, and it says the Eurozone ministers handed Greece an ultimatum on Monday to request an extension to its bailout program after crunch talks collapsed, deepening a bitter standoff that risks seeing Athens bid farewell to the euro. Oh, how sad if Athens should bid farewell to the euro, which it never should have been a part of anyway. And that's a position I've had for a long time. I just cannot really understand I guess I understand why, but it doesn't make any sense to me that Europe and the Eurozone and the European Union, whatever, should be so worried and upset that Greece might leave. That Greece might leave the Eurozone. As I already said, he should never have been there to begin with. And if Greece also leaves the European Union, well, that's good too. It's good if more and more, if some of them leave the European Union. It's too big, and there's too many different and varied nations in it. It can't work. Anyway, I'm going to go on with the article. It says, despite the acrimony, Greece Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis said the different sides could come to an agreement on the bailout within the next 2 days, with the possibility of another make-or-break meeting on Friday. Well, that's this finance minister who people say is so charming and so on, but to me, he looks like a gangster. But actually, he is always positive and smiling, and he's not always smiling, but he's always totally positive. I think that's a tactic they're using to say, oh, we're going to find an agreement. Don't worry, we'll find an agreement. So when the agreement doesn't come, it won't be their fault or whatever. Maybe they think that will make an agreement come. To go on, Varoufakis said, I have no doubt there is going to be an agreement in the end. See, that's typically what he's saying, even though the talks abruptly ended after only a few hours. Eurogroup head Jeroen Dijsselbloem, I don't know how to pronounce that name, he's a Dutchman, said Greece had the rest of the week to request an extension to the program, which expires at the end of the month, challenging Athens to cave in on its dearly held position. So they want Athens, they want this new government of Greece to give up on its political position that it ran its campaign on. But they say they're not going to do it. but both sides are waiting for the other one to give in. So this Dijsselbloem, the Eurogroup head, who's a young guy, youngish guy, well, he looks youngish, said, given the timelines we have, we can use this week, but that is about it, he said, who is also Dutch finance minister and a defender of austerity policies in the Eurozone. Well, I'm a defender of austerity policies too, I guess. A Greek government source dismissed the demand to stick to its current bailout as absurd and accused Dijsselbloem of inserting a last minute proposal that he knows Greek authorities will refuse. Well, that's all I took from that article. The rest is all repetition of as they go on explaining how it all came about. But these, you know, my comment is that these Greeks are absurd themselves. They're calling the Eurozone people absurd, the bailout of their demands absurd. They're absurd in thinking they should call the terms in all this. I'm hoping they'll be booted from the Eurozone. Well, I've already said that. You know, Greece is a Balkan state. I had to look that up because I thought, well, it should be, but is it considered part of the Balkans? Yes, it is. The countries in the Balkan Peninsula are Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Slovenia, Serbia, Montenegro, Kosovo, Macedonia, Romania, Bulgaria, Albania, Greece, and the European part of Turkey. Well, not one of them should be in a financial core group of Europe and of dealing with the euro and so on. It's ridiculous. And I guess Greece is the only one there, but they made a mistake when they allowed that to happen. Okay, now on to the topic for tonight, which I will preface by saying that I have finally gotten the Hitler's Platterhof speech that Veronica Clark had published in two different books. I got it. I purchased it from the Institute for Contemporary History in Munich, which took a while to get that done and then get it all here. And then I sent it to Carlos Porter to translate, and he didn't get to it right away. When he did, then I didn't get to it when he had finished it for a while, because I had other things that were a priority. So, but now it's there, and I've been working very hard, and both Part 1 and Part 2 are now posted at KarenJaeger.net, and now I'm going to discuss it on this program tonight. In looking into some things, I found some things that I think are very interesting. And one thing that I knew before already, though, was that this talk, and the first thing I want to say is that it's clearly not a speech. It was never, if the title on the title page is Ansprache der Führer, but it's not a proper speech, and it wasn't the only one of some talks that Hitler was giving to officers at this time. I'm not saying there are a lot of them, but there might have been at least two. And he was seated when this was going on. And you don't give a speech when you're sitting down, when he was sitting down. And it was nobody but him spoke, but it was kind of, it seemed to be a little bit on the informal side, which is the way he wanted it to be. Now, it took place at the Platterhof Hotel on Obersalzberg in May 1944, and he was staying, obviously, at his private home, the Berghof, and all these officers came there, as they often did, but there it was arranged that they would all come there and spend some time, communicating with the Führer. We know that in May 1944, there were a lot of questions about the outcome of the war on the Eastern Front, and there were a lot of setbacks and a lot of stress. And Hitler, in my opinion, wanted to build up the morale of his officer corps and explain to them why he had no plan to give up, why that he didn't want them to give up, that they should have confidence and fight it all out. And we know that in August of 1944, there was the, let me see, I'm always forgetting the name of that now. I really shouldn't. All I have to do is look at my website and I'll see it. The assassination attempt on Hitler's life that took place there at Wolfschanze, at the Wolfschanze headquarters. So all along I've been saying that this speech, so-called speech, was not about race, but I find now that after reading the whole thing from another translation that it is about leadership. It's basically about leadership. But Veronica Clark found this, got wind of this speech, found it, and got it translated, then published it as a book under the title Hitler's Most Significant Speech, and in which she claimed that it was all about race and Hitler's change of mind about race and the German race not being a pure race, and based on her idea that she was promoting that race had lost its importance to Hitler, that he recognized that the Germans were a mixed race already, and he was quite open to bringing in Slavic elements, and even quite open to Arab elements and Negro elements from Africa, and all sorts of crazy things she's put in these books. But the fact that, let's say that, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here. Let me go back to where some of the things that she said is wrong. In the first place, this talk is not Hitler's most significant speech. She's the only one who thinks so. But she titled her book that way because she wanted to call it that for two reasons: to sell the book, to make the book seem important, and to make her interpretation of what Hitler said seem to be revelations in this speech that he had never made before. And this made it so very significant. And everybody fell for it right off the bat because they weren't familiar with it to begin with. And so they took what she said as just accepted it. This is another point I'd like to bring out, how we do this, how we accept what a certain people do if they come across as imposing, or they come across as confident in that they have some kind of a background and they know what they're talking about, then we accept what they say without any question, without looking into it any deeper, because people do not want to bother themselves with critical research. They want to just take things as they are and then kind of get on the bandwagon and say, oh, this is great, you know, so on, without asking the right kind of questions. And one of those people who jumped at this, and he's not the only one, but people who should be more careful, is John Friend. But he's just one that comes to mind because he wrote a comment about the book on Amazon and how great it was. But that was the second version of that. So let's take a look at the first book. I'm going to talk about this speech, but I'm just going to get this part out of the way for now, about how Veronica Clark has absolutely misrepresented this. And it tells you that she misrepresents and is capable of misrepresenting just about anything. And she has done so. This book, Hitler's Most Significant Speech, was only printed, and of course she prints her own book, so she can do it however she wants. It doesn't cost that much, and she designs the covers or has somebody design them, and she just prints up a certain amount and then puts them on Amazon, and it doesn't require much to put out books these days. She says that it says that there was an edition of 100 books for Hitler's Most Significant Speech. That's all. And on the title page, she has Wilfried Hank as the translator, not herself, although later she added herself as translator along with Wilfried Hank. She has a translator's note by Friedrich Berg. Here we have where this woman gets people like Wilfried Hank, Friedrich Berg, and also the late Hans Krappe to do a bunch of translating for her and even helping her out in every way talked about this before, so I'm not going to go into it, but it's kind of, here we have these people who do not really care what she says, but they just are attracted to her for one reason or another, and she's able to get people to help her. I'm going to work my way into calling her a swindler. I think these books are swindles, and most of her books are swindles. What's interesting is that we've been reading in Table Talk in the last week where Hitler is talking about swindlers, and he points out how so many people of high repute and intelligence and so on get taken in by these, what he calls, and what's a popular common word to use in Germany, swindlers. And he talks about a few of them that they have an ability to get people to believe them and help them. And this is the way I see Veronica Clark. She gets Friedrich Berg to speak up for her all the time. And then if you present some of the things that aren't right, that aren't true about what she writes, he and others just say, well, that's her opinion, and she can have her opinion. I don't agree with everything she says and so on. But why then do they write recommendations for her like this? Now, he writes, translations are tricky. This is Fritz Berg saying this. They can be lots of hard work, but they can also be a legitimate opportunity to enhance and clarify the meaning of the original text. I understand perfectly. I don't want to hear from translators or people about how you have to translate into another language and you have to change things so that it makes sense in the other language. I understand all that. But you do not need to change the meaning of what the original writer had to say. That's what I'm getting at. And he says Hitler's thoughts and writing in some instances are just not all that great. That can be said about everyone, so this is not an insult to Hitler. Well, what do you mean it can be said about everyone? Whatever Hitler's thoughts and writing are, that's what we should hear. That's what we want to know. We don't want it doctored up by somebody like Fritz Berg or Veronica Clark, or we don't need to have it made easier for us to read by these people and maybe not give us the idea of how Hitler thought and spoke. He says sometimes the original text is not all that great to begin with. Of course, he says one may cross a gray line between legitimate translating and rewriting. But if one is honest about all this and one is really clever, the translated text may convey the author's message in a new language far better than the author did in his original language. Well, I find that a little bit questionable to say things like that. But we'll find out if the translation that he obviously took part in, as according to Veronica Clark anyway, that he had a part in this translation too, was improved over what someone else has translated it as. And then he says some more, but I'm not going to go into that anymore now. That's plenty. Now, the other thing is, I said, this is not a speech. And it's a talk, and this is not, so it's wrong to call it a speech. And it's not about race, it's not about Aryans, it's not about Nordics, and it's not about Slavs. Because in the description of the book on Veronica Clark's site on Amazon, okay, let me tell you too that the first book, Hitler's Most Significant Speech, I don't know how much she charged for it to begin with, but she made 100. And then, of course, they were gone. I don't know if they were all sold or what, but they were gone. And after they were gone, she didn't want to print anymore. And on Amazon, it says that there's somebody offering one used copy, their own, I suppose, for $2,904. And that's the kind of thing Clark likes to do. She likes to print small editions and then hope that it's going to make the then put high prices on what's left or what somebody's willing to sell, like it's a collector's edition. That's what she wants to turn her books into. She did that in 2009, that book came out, and then in 2012 she brought out this this so-called speech again in another book with a speech by Himmler. And so she had titled it Hitler and Himmler Uncensored, sort of a stupid title for a book like this. But she says on this book, she says about this book, and she charges $60 for the hardback and $36 for the paperback. And she says on Amazon that two hitherto unpublished top secret speeches by Hitler and Himmler, never before available in English until now, beginning with an exploration into the theoretical versus operational definitions of Volk, race, Nordic, and Aryan. Author Veronica K. Clark sets the stage for two of the most important and revealing speeches ever delivered by Heinrich Himmler and Adolf Hitler in 1943 and 1944, respectively. Now, this beginning with an exploration into the theoretical versus operational definitions of Volk, race, Nordic, and Aryan is certainly not in the book by Hitler or in by Himmler, but is in her book. She starts with something like that, kind of, sort of, in the book. So, you know, she's talking about her book, not what people are paying to read, and that is these so-called speeches. She goes on to say, were Hitler and Himmler really as anti-Slavic and racist as historians have made them out to be? Well, there's nothing in the speech about in the Hitler speech about that, but she puts Hitler's name here. Was Hitler as anti-Slavic and racist as historians have made them out to be? You won't find an answer to that in this speech by Hitler. But then she says, when speaking to their innermost circles of supporters and comrades, did they advocate uber racial supremacy, or were they less racist than most of us ever imagined? If you believe Himmler and Hitler, well, let's just stick with Hitler, if you believe Hitler was all about Slavic and Polish genocide and Aryan supermen, think again. Well, people will think that this is what they're going to find in this book, but they only find maybe a little bit of talk by what Veronica puts in there from other people about that. But what she's doing is setting up a straw man. She's setting up the straw man that Hitler was, or people think he was, an uber racist, and then she can knock it down in this book, which she doesn't even do, but anyway, that's the idea. So it's very dishonest. And the word Slav does not appear in the Platterhoff talk or the word Slavic at all, nor does the word genocide appear. And the word Polish appears once, and not in any kind of a way that she's referring to here. So you might say, well, lots of books have these kind of blurbs to get people to buy the book. That's true, but is that honest? And is that honest for somebody who's supposedly a serious scholar in the movement who's trying to, and she writes this stuff herself. It's not that she has a publisher doing it, that she doesn't have any choice in the matter, because she's her own publisher. The book's, the foreword to this book says, yeah, okay, here's what's really horrible. This is really horrible. You have a table of contents. This is in the second book, Hitler and Himmler Uncensored. Then you have the foreword. Then she has, right under the title foreword, a quote, a supposed quote from Adolf Hitler. And it gives the quote, and then it gives, you know how they do afterwards, a dash, and then the name Adolf Hitler. No time, no place. No reference to where Adolf Hitler said this to show that he said this. It's just his name there. Now, that's something you see in real schluck junk books. Boy, you see that in these books that, like something like Hitler, the founder of Israel, books like that in which they use all kinds of lies and the quotes, they give quotes from people and they just say the name there, but they don't tell you where to find the quote. And she's done this here. And she recommends all those books too. In her career, she takes her information from these books, these schluck books. So she reads them all, but then she also believes half of what she reads in there and uses it in her radio interviews and so on. She has done that a lot. I see now that she also does this in her own work. She's doing this in her own work. And this quote that she has Adolf Hitler's name on, I'm going to read it in a minute, is not by Adolf Hitler. It's not a quote by Adolf Hitler. Hitler never spoke it, and he never read it. Wrote it. So this is beyond dishonesty. I want you to understand that this is fraudulent. It's pure fraud. Now, this quote actually is from a man who wrote a book about Adolf Hitler. And in his book, he wrote all these long quotes. He put it in, he put it in quote marks, but he said, he had spent some time with Adolf Hitler in 1929 to 1932, let's say, as a close associate of Hitler's during that time. And then in 1946, after the war, when everybody close to Hitler was hunted down and he was detained by the British for a while. I'm talking about Otto Wagner, who wrote the book Hitler, Memoirs of a Confidant. So we're talking about 15 years later, while he was in British custody detention, he had plenty of time and he recalled everything he remembered Hitler is saying during those years and put it down in his book. Well, he could probably, supposedly he took some notes at the time, but he could put the general idea of what he, as he remembers Hitler speaking and be pretty accurate, but he can't quote Hitler exactly after 15 years. And people who think they have these great memories, I've talked about memory before, and we all think we remember things, but if we're tested on it, we're all shocked to find out that how poor our memory is, that even though we're sure that's the way it was, it wasn't that way, and we've simply remembered it a little bit or a lot differently than it really was. So this quote in this book of hers that people have been buying and praising is a fraudulent quote. It's not by Adolf Hitler. And it says, a Volk in the current political sense has ceased to be a racial unit, a racially pure community. The great migration of world history, the military expeditions, the times of enemy occupation, and also, of course, the admixture that became ever more frequent as a result of international trade relations, has seen to it that all sorts of races and racial mixtures live side by side within the borders of any state. Does that sound like Adolf Hitler? Well, she says it is, without, of course, giving any more details about it. I found this, I have that book, and I found the passage that this is taken from, and it's from page 165, and it's part of a chapter on the meaning of Volk community. And if you put it in the context, it has an entirely different feel to it, because Hitler said that in spite of what he, and this isn't even Hitler, let's remember, this is Otto Wagner speaking for Hitler. And Otto Wagner remembers Hitler saying, after he said that paragraph, that nevertheless, most nations are the structures within certain areas where either the old tribal system has survived as a community, has come into being over time, that was consolidated into a Volk, possessing its own style, its own language, its own attitudes on ethics and morality, and its own culture. So he is saying, in spite of the fact that originally different races and racial mixtures came together in all these long migrations. What's he talking? The reference here is to the great migrations of world history. That still, in time, these groups consolidated into a Volk, possessing its own style, own language, own attitudes on ethics and morality, and so on. And he says it makes them into what he calls a people or a Volk. Going to read any more of that. That gives you the idea. Then we have a translation of Wilhelm Schmidt's some excerpts from his book Rasse und Volk. And of course, Veronica has picked out the excerpts that she wants to put in her book. whatever it's supposed to mean, I don't know, but she's trying to connect the idea that race and folk are not the same. This is why this is in here, because this is her whole thrust in this Flatterhoff so-called speech, as she calls it, is that race and people, race and folk are not the same, because the folk is made up of many races or several races. So this is why she's got this here, to promote this idea. And then after that, she's got this silly story of an anonymous man whose identity has never been revealed. I don't know his relationship to Germans, and I think he's a Russian or something. And this is supposed to also put people in mind of how we're all mixed together and how we all get along together. And the Russians and the Slavs and the Germans are friends and so on. Okay. And then the translation. So now we can go to the translation itself. I was saying we have now Carlos Porter's translation. And how different is it? Well, of course, it's different, but it's not saying anything it's not saying anything outstandingly different. And in the first 12 or so pages of this so-called speech, there's not much to talk about. It's not that it isn't interesting, but he's going over some general things that are not too outstanding with the officers. And then in this one, on my page 11, he says that he has these convictions and his confidence is unbreakable. He says, "It must be so, since, gentlemen, if I did not possess this confidence, then I would not be sitting before you now." He uses the word sitting, and I'm sure he did say sitting, or Carlos Porter would not have used sitting. But it just so happens that Clark's translation, she says, "If I would not have this conviction, I would not be standing here before you." So I do think, I don't know this for sure, but I do think he must have written sitting. And if you're translating German, you know the difference between sitting and standing. But that day, she wanted to make it standing because she was calling it a speech, and it didn't sound very good to have a speech if you're sitting before the people you're talking to. So I do believe she changed that. I'm just making a stab at that because I think it would have to have been. I didn't look at that line in the German, which I did on some things, but I didn't on that. I should have, but I didn't think that was the most important thing that I'm going to talk about. So after that, we go on a little bit more, and Hitler is talking about how he decided to go into politics. He's telling them about his interest in architecture and that he believed he was going to become the greatest, a great architect after the war. But after the terrible end of the war and what happened, which he thought was just absolutely tragic and catastrophic, he said that based on the recognition that he had the recognition that the German people would be completely unable to rise again unless there was a fundamental change in the leadership of this German people and in the organization of its society, and especially in the cleansing of this German people, in maintaining the purity of this German people. Now, he talks like this quite a bit in this talk to the officers, and he always has. And I want to point out again that I've been reading with Ray Goodwin, the table talk, and we find that Hitler mentions the importance of keeping the racial purity of the German people, and not so much he doesn't use the word purity, but keeping that race is so important in his opinion to the quality of the people, that he's not in favor in ever of bringing foreign races in or mixing races. And he makes a big distinction between Slavic and Germanic. He doesn't do that here, but because he's not even talking about Slavic in this so-called speech. But he does bring up, use a lot of language that is very much where he sees German as the distinctive people of his people, who his people are, that he wants to keep intact and that he's defending. And so that there's that sentence there. It's on page 13. Not that you have page numbers, but... And in the Veronica Clark translation, he says that he's basing this on a conviction that the Germans will... He based his decision to go into politics on the conviction that the Germans will never rise, will never again rise, unless a fundamental change takes place in regards to the leadership of the German people, in the organization of its society, but mainly that an effort has to be made to purify our people, an effort to maintain a pure society. Well, I just think that this is written in a little bit more mild fashion than Hitler actually said it. If he said that, he said all that about a fundamental change in the leadership, and in the, I didn't read that part, or did I? I guess I did. And he ended it with, especially in the cleansing of this German people, in maintaining the purity of this German people. And it seems as though Veronica Clark didn't want to use that kind of language that strongly, and changed it and interpreted it as mainly that an effort has to be made to purify our people and to maintain a pure society. Well, what's a pure society? And what's purifying our people? What does that mean? It's not as clear as when you say you need to maintain, you need to have a cleansing in this German people and maintain the purity of this German people, which is not talking about cleansing them racially, but cleansing their ideas, cleansing their thinking. So I thought that just showed a little bit of a bias in one direction. And then on page 15, Hitler is speaking, saying, when the war came to this tragic end for Germany, I had to first say goodbye to my only great passion in this life, and I decided, based on my living experience, to undertake the reorganization of a new German racial corpus. That's how Carlos Porter translated it. He translated Volkskörper in as racial corpus, VolksKörper. He says that he's not sure that that's a good translation, but that he said is a uniquely national socialist word. Others, the Veronica Clark's group translated it as a new folk body, which seems to be a good way to translate it. Hitler went on to say, I say body of the people, already something different from what many other German politicians had in mind. The bourgeois politicians only saw the state before their eyes. I saw the people, the substance. For me, the state was nothing more than a purely exterior, even a compulsory form. So he's putting across here that for him, the state is racial body of the people. Carlos Porter uses the word racial body. Veronica Clark uses the word folk body. Which is not necessarily, not, she doesn't use the word racial. So he's telling them how he threw himself into this mission, and this is where what a struggle he had in doing it. And all this story has been told before, and he's talked about it on Table Talk. Now, this is 1944, and where we're at in Table Talk is 1942 now. We're now at August 1942, so we've been through 41 and 42, and truthfully, he's covered a whole lot of things that are mentioned in this speech, and he's talked about it all before. So, and I want to make the point, which I've made before, but that there's nothing new in this speech by Adolf Hitler. Everything in this speech he said before, and like I'm pointing out, some of it in 1941, in 1942, some of it in 1931. So it's to say that, well, this is such a significant speech, which is the case that Veronica Clark made at one time, so significant because Hitler has revealed in this speech that he's changed his thinking about race. This is what she was saying. You know, she's always taking things off the internet. She puts things on, she takes things off. She puts up WordPress websites and then takes them down. So, and she changes things too all the time. She even changes things in her books after she's published them. Or that's one reason she publishes small editions. Then she prints the book up again with a different cover, sometimes even a different title, but it's the same material. But she's made changes in it since the first time. Then she publishes it again, and you know, in a small edition. It's all very slippery, and slippery to the point where it's absolutely dishonest. And I'll use that word fraudulent once again, because it fits. So he is saying that, yeah, he's saying all these things. And he says that he's going to use the word worldview. He said, I also formed the concept of a new worldview for the new movement. He's talking to the officers here. Now, this word worldview is in the mouths of innumerable people, even then, and will continue to be mentioned. But I must tell you quite briefly what a worldview is. Really is, he means. It's a definition which, in my view, is quite necessary, since, as I said, the word is used too strongly and in the end no longer meant anything certain or definite. And he goes on. But the Veronica Clark's translation of this says, uses the word ideology for worldview. Well, we know there's that word Weltanschauung. Weltanschauung is worldview. And that's such a such a well-known German word that it's used like in other languages without translating it into worldview or the equivalent. It's just used as Weltanschauung. But for some reason, Veronica Clark translated it as ideology. Ideology. And says, I also began to form an ideology for the new movement. The word ideology has been promulgated by many, even then, and that will not change. That's not too clear to me, but this was something I found a little bit interesting, why they picked the word ideology for worldview, which I would think, okay, now here's the same person calling again. I'm going to answer the call and see just who it is. Hello, caller. Hello, caller. Are you just listening?
Hello.
You just, sounds like chatting.
I want to
Yeah, you think I need a co-host?
I just want to say, what?
You think I need a co-host? I'm kind of stumbling around here tonight.
Well, I couldn't hear you until just a minute ago. I've been struggling with trying to hear you, but I heard you talking about worldview, ideology. And
Well, he's dropped. I guess he's having trouble. You know, he uses a Google phone number, and he's having trouble staying on the line. He's having trouble even listening, I guess. Well, we'll go on. I'll go on because that's not the most important thing I had to talk about anyway. But it's always nice to hear from Hattie. He'll maybe be able to come on later on in the show. So let's see. I'm trying to also point out some of the things I think are most interesting in this talk of Hitler's from the new Carlos Porter translation. And he says he came to the conclusion that if he recognizes a view to be correct, then not only do I have a duty to communicate this perception to my fellow citizens in a state, but also to eliminate contrary perceptions. Now, he said he's talked about this before. This is not new either. But I think this is a very interesting statement of Hitler's and belief of Hitler's that he has puts right out there, saying that if he thinks something is correct and is absolutely the right way to do things, the right way to go, the right perception, then he thinks he has a duty not only to promote that and to communicate that, but to eliminate the contrary perceptions. So that's why he's not a Democrat. He's not a person who's promoting democracy, where we have all these different views and everybody gets to have their view and we listen to everybody and then we vote or something like that. But he's saying that there's one right way or best way for, maybe it's not the same for all peoples, but for his people, there's one best way, then the others' ways have to be stamped out because they're only getting in the way of doing things the best way. And he goes on with that a little bit further on and makes this statement, tolerance is only understandable as signs of inner insecurity. He's speaking against tolerance, saying it doesn't exist in nature. In the moment that I am completely certain of a problem, not only do I have the right to communicate the problem or this attitude, but rather the duty to eliminate the other. So he's repeated that again. That's one of his hard and fast rules. Now, going on quite a bit, which is not too exceptional, not that it isn't interesting and good, but that's not something I want to mention tonight, is we come to where I'm on page 27, or close to it, and he says that, speaking about the German people again, at the time of the beginning of his struggle against degeneration, a decision had to be made, namely, was the collapse of 1918 the end of the German nation, or was it the beginning of a new body of the people? So, of course, he thought the latter, but he says, in our country, we have a people that cannot be considered comparable or equivalent to a race. So this is what leads up to this section, this part where he's talking about race. And this is the part that Veronica Clark has turned into being the sole purpose of this speech and the main topic of this speech, which I've said before is just one page or a page and a half or something, a number of paragraphs, and that's it in this whole 70-page speech. Here's where we get into it, and what led him to it was talking about how to build up the German people after 1918, how to build up the nation, and that that's what he saw was needed first. First, he had to build up the people, the German people, into a stronger people because of what had happened with all that communist infiltration and the Spartacus movement and all of that stuff. So he needed a party. That's why he said that was the purpose of the political party, because the party was going to remake the people. So that brings him to this topic of talking about race. And he said, in our country, we have a people that cannot be considered comparable or equivalent to a race. And this was for Veronica Clark. Oh, a lightning bolt. Wow. Wow. He's saying that the Germans are not a race. Well, it's not something he hadn't said before, and it hadn't been discussed in Germany quite a bit, just what the Germans were and how you think of race and how you think of Volk and how you think of nation and so on. It's not new. But he went on to say, when I began my educational process almost 25 years ago, it wasn't this way, but rather many bourgeois groups repeatedly criticized me, saying people and race are the same. And Hitler says, no, people and race aren't the same. Race is a blood component. It's the blood-based nucleus, but the people very often consist not of one race, but of 2, 3, 4, and 5 different racial nuclei. Then Carlos has got that in German, too, just so people don't confuse any of it. And then he says, nevertheless, it is not possible and not desirable to dissolve such a body of the people. But that's because they have become a people. That's what he means by that. Because by now, you can't dissolve them. You can't separate them out into different race. You know, I see you've got more of this and you've got more of that. Because they've all become a people, and therefore they're, as I just said, you can't really break them apart again. When one regards the German people as purely, I'm just taking out a few key words here. When one regards the German people as purely biological, he says, but they have, well, maybe I need to read the whole thing. Okay, when one regards the German people from this point of view as purely biological, then we see a union of people with the same language, consolidated through the circuitous route of state formation, that is perhaps the decisive thing here, but of various racial origins, a Nordic racial nucleus, also Eastern elements are present as well. It's hard to know what he means by that, because he says a Nordic racial nucleus, but Eastern elements are present as well. Also Mediterranean racial nuclei, and then still a European base race that's in it all, that's mixed in, which is a prehistorical, or what I just would say prehistoric, what we think of as prehistoric, so we don't know anything about it because it's before our history. That race, we're no longer able to identify specifically, but which is there. It was already there among the Greeks, he says. The Helots of the Spartans consisted of them. And that this racial nucleus lies concealed in our people as well, this prehistoric one. So what he's talking about here is kind of like what you find out in your DNA test. You've got bits and pieces of all this stuff in there, and yet that doesn't tell what you are as is in more modern, in the modern age, where your ancestors were living and what culture they were participating in. The fact that you have a little bit of this and a little bit of that, a little bit of something else, doesn't give that distinction, or doesn't give you that the real information about what culture and what race, as we call it, what nationality, what ethnicity you belong to. And so he says, so Hitler says that we see a people that consists of various racial nuclei. These racial nuclei in the individual possess their special abilities, since the abilities lie not primarily in the people, rather they lie primarily in the race. So he's saying what the racial nuclei that is most prevalent in you, and even those that aren't most prevalent, whatever is there, is what give you your abilities. It's not necessarily the people you come from, the Volk, because within this Volk is where these abilities lie. The abilities are in the race. If you can follow that, it makes kind of sense to me. It makes sense to me, but I don't think I can explain it very well to somebody else. But now this is, what I'm reading now is from Carlos Porter's translation, and I don't have any problem with Veronica Clark's translation in this, in any of this part. It's all about the same. You know, it's all very, it's saying the same thing. And another line that stands out to me is, we have now united. Okay, after saying this, then Hitler says, and talking a little bit more about it, he says, we have now united this racial nucleus in our people. But it is now decisive for me to bring forth the leading racial nucleus among the various abilities. And he starts out talking about the artistic ability, but what he's really interested in is the leadership ability. And then, he goes on to say, this is decisive because for the leadership of a people, only the Nordic racial component has any real value. And he's, because this whole speech to the officers is about leadership. So now he's left that racial thing behind already, pretty much. A little bit of it comes up still, but he's saying now, because we're concerned with leadership, and that's the most important thing for us now, that we are raising up generations of leaders, thinking about the future. He's thinking about right now, but he's also thinking about the future, that what the German people need are leaders. And because Hitler was envisioning at this time, what he says at the very end of the speech, that the Germans are going to rule Europe, this new union of Europe that he envisions is going to be led by Germans and their Germanic kin. Therefore, leadership is of utmost importance in the people. So he says here that only the Nordic racial component has any real value for leadership. And then he points out that, you know, you might think that if a man's son is going to take after him, but he points out that it's not just as much the son will take after his mother, and the daughter will take after the father. And So if a Nordic man marries an Eastern woman, and I take it that Eastern, by Eastern, he means Slavic, if a Nordic man marries a Slavic woman, the child of the same sex is not necessarily going to be Nordic. It might be Slavic and take after the mother. So he's just, I don't know what point he's trying to make with that. He's just saying it, that this is that this happens and that he's looking for, he's looking to bring forth the Nordic more than, well, he doesn't want everybody to be that, but he says we need these leaders, you know, we need a certain amount of leadership material and we need a certain amount of people with these Nordic qualities. And I want to say that people who get the idea that Nordic is blonde and blonde hair and blue eyes is are wrong, because you know, people will say, well, you know, the Poles and the Russians are more Nordic than the Germans. Well, I think when they say that, they mean that they're more blonde and blue-eyed. But that's not what Nordic is. So it's a mental and character quality, and it's personified in leadership and organizational ability. And I also think in objectivity, the ability to be objective in your outlook. And then he starts talking about the capitalism and the capitalist mindset, which gets in the way of the mindset that he wants to develop amongst the German people. He mentions here, when he mentions Nordic, he mentions mentally. He says the non-Nordic people who are mentally completely unfit for leadership. So he's saying that the non-Nordic people are the people who might be more attracted to materialism. Therefore, he says these people get ahead in life, and if they make a lot of money, if they have the commercial spirit, because he's, well, I don't know where that is. He's talking about the different spirits. He talked about the commercial spirit, which finds its highest realization amongst the Jews, he says. But this commercial spirit gets into a lot of people, and then they, because they have money, they send their children to expensive or the best schools, and then because their children graduated from the best schools or even graduated from higher education at all, they get the jobs and they get the important positions in the political life and the business life of the nation. So then they become the leaders, but he says they don't have, if they don't have the Nordic element, they don't have the ability to be leaders. They're not natural leaders. And so you have your nation being led by people who are not decent leaders and not good leaders and not capable of leadership. This is what he's pointing out here. And so from here he goes to saying that what National Socialism is doing is looking throughout the entire nation and the entire people to find talented children and youths, and to take them under our wing and help them to educate them and so on, and help them to develop their full capabilities and become the leaders of the future. And this is how they will keep the nation strong and moving ahead in the future, even after he's gone. He doesn't say that, but you know, you have to know he's thinking. That's the idea. By continually developing leaders among the people. And this is the best way to do it. You don't do it among the bourgeois, the wealthy, which is what we have, say, in, well, certainly have it in the United States, and I suppose in all in European countries, where the wealthy, and they take the people from the best schools, and they're the ones who run everything. Sometimes they're okay, but sometimes there's not, and that's when you have you're not getting people from the entire nation. And he goes on some more about that and points out why that is most effective, and you get the best people that way if you're doing that. There's so many interesting things in here that he says, but I'm going to run out of time if I don't move along here. But he says that this bourgeoisie is not a racial term, but it's an economic concept. And the bourgeoisie are composed of these elements who succeeded economically, but they're not the best racial material that we have to work with. Then he's talking about how in his party and when he started his party, he made it clear to everyone that you rise to leadership if you're able to lead. And nobody cares where you come from or where this ability whether this leadership ability is in demand, and that this leadership ability that they find in amongst the common people is in demand. They want it, and they're going to train these people, and they're going to help them become what they can be. So then he talks about what makes a leader and what a leader is like, and all this has also been talked about so many times. I've read it. I think a lot of it is in Table Talk, but other places too. It's in Mein Kampf, where he talks about his own childhood and school days and so on. He talks about teachers all the children give a hard time to, and then a real good teacher who's got leadership ability comes along, and all the kids just do anything he says and follow him, and are very happy with him. And that, so he says that a leader is worshipped and can achieve anything with his soldiers, while another who can't keep shop can't maintain the slightest discipline. Why? Because he's not a leader. So he's saying that this leadership is inborn, and it's racial, and that he pinpoints the Nordic racial elements as having the qualities of those qualities. And then he talks about how he wants radical people in his party. So he's not at all becoming more easygoing or becoming more laid back about race and so on, and about he's not inviting everybody into the party, or he's not inviting everybody into the nation. And he's telling these officers that people have asked him in the past, why do you use such a radical tone in your program? And Hitler says, because I need radical people. You know, these officers that are listening to him, up to the level of general and field marshal, if there are some of those there, well, Goering's a field a marshal, and he's there. But some of them are sincerely admire Hitler and look up to him, and some of them might believe all the National Socialist things, and some of them don't. And he knows that. And some of the highest level ones, because I already mentioned how the Valkyrie assassination plot took place only a few months later, and that was led by military men who were anti-Hitler. So he knows there's these anti-Hitler elements, and he's talking to all of them. All of the people, the ones who are for him and the ones who are against him, and wanting to give his case and persuade them to see it from his point of view, and to explain to them why he's doing what he's doing. And some of these criticisms might be in the minds of some of these officers when he says something like, people ask him, why is he so radical? Because they didn't like that radical. That the being so rattled, particularly these ones who had long histories in the military and long names and had been part of the sort of the semi-nobility or the upper class and what have you. And Hitler says, I rejected a lot of people I didn't want. And they applaud that. But he said, he told people that, people said, why do you have this, I don't know where that is, why do you have this rule? Oh, here, some people would say to him, if you leave out this one point, then I'll become a member right away. And his answer to that was, that point is in there so that you can't become a member because I don't want you. And he says that this is important. And the people, the officers applaud him. And he says, I rejected a lot of people I didn't want. So he's very clear. Even at that point, in 1944, that he doesn't want people that aren't up to snuff, as he sees it. He's not hard up. He never felt, well, I gotta just try to make friends with more people or get more people in here or something because we're not doing so well. He didn't think that way. He wanted to maybe even tighten it up even more to keep these people out. Now I'm going to get just to something that's very important here. I don't have anything marked here for a long way. It's not that it isn't good, but he is saying on page 45 that he's talking about setbacks and he's talking about being in a crisis. And he's telling them that while they think they're facing crises now with the war, that the crises with the battles and the war and so on are bad, but he says he's faced worse crises than this in building up the party, just building up the party. And he says to them, do not say that that was less important. He says, it was my life and my conviction, and Germany depended on it. And then he says that the polls, here's where he mentions the polls for the only time. He said Germany depended on the party at that time exactly the way it depends on the outcome of the war today. And if we hadn't succeeded in building it up, that is the party, then sooner or later the Bolshevik hordes would have overwhelmed Europe. So his National Socialist Party and his program is what kept that from happening. And then he says that the Poles would ever have restrained themselves and all the rest of it, nobody believes that today with what we know now. Well, and what he means is that the Polish state was not capable of stopping the Bolshevik hordes, but the National Socialist Party was what did it. That the Polish state could never have made a difference in all of that as a buffer, you know, as saying, well, we have the Polish state between us and Russia, and then they'll fight it out there. No, he said that was never going to happen. They never could have done that. And took the Germans building up their larger state to do that. And then he says, he's talking about great men, and that all great men had crises to face. I think there must have been, well, just the fact that things were so tough at this time. And he's trying to put it in perspective and saying that if we always have crises to face. He says, whether it's a Martin Luther or out of recent history, I don't know, Frederick the Great or Richard Wagner in another field. I've taken three different fields, but they're all men who constantly had to overcome some catastrophe and in the end, with their stubbornness and their tenacity, who achieved their goals and fought their way through. And that's part of the message he's wanting to convey to these officers. And then we get to where he says, page 48, and page 48 I posted so that you could read it on the program page for this program, and it's also on the blog talk page for in the slideshow there on blog talk, but it's also on the program page on carolynyeager.net, because this is the most important part of what I consider to be a problem with the with Veronica Clark's translation. And on page 48, it starts out saying that he was naturally shot at by both sides. He says, I attempted to define this new concept with the motto that nationalism and socialism are the same in the end, namely that the people are the center of everything worthwhile. That is not any particular class interest as antithesis, but rather the people at the center of everything worthwhile. Because socialism is nothing more than the struggle for this people as a whole, and nationalism is the same thing. Well, he said this before, and it's very interesting, though, that he puts it this way, and it's very true, too, that nationalism entails socialism. And socialism, if it's sincerely done, would entail nationalism. So although we have socialism, that's not nationalism, but that's it's not a healthy thing. But he sees why he calls his his movement, National Socialism. And then he says, I had serious fights with both the right and the left at that time. The left declared, it's impossible, we cannot go with the nationalists, because they understood nationalism to mean the bourgeoisie. And vice versa, the bourgeoisie rejected socialism because they understood socialism to mean Marxism, that is, internationalism. So this is the context in which he then says, but one thing was clear, people, in quotes, and people, in quotes, are not the same. Okay, that I can imagine a people, in quotes, with a thin ruling class and a perfectly miserable mass of poor folk, squalid, louse-ridden, filthy, but raised to blind obedience, who simply follow. I can imagine that. This idea awakens no satisfaction in me. I find it horrible. What I believe is the first, most worthwhile ideal to have is to see, to have to see, is a people, in quotes, who look healthy. So he is saying people and people are not the same. Now this is Carlos Porter's translation, and I check it out in the German, and it says, and you can see it for yourself, it says Volk und Volk, and then that is, or not the disable, disable. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't try to read it. But in Veronica Clark's translation, it is strangely, but now it is clear, nevertheless, race and people are not the same. And I can imagine a nation with a small upper class and a totally impoverished public mass, dilapidated, lice-ridden, and filthy. Then it goes on similar to what other translation. But now here you find something that's very strange, because you can't not see that says Volk und Volk. And Volk und Volk is people and people. It's not race. Volk is never race. So it's not race and people, but she put in race and people. And I can't believe that Wilf Heinck translated it that way. So I can only think that she changed it that way because of the previous section in the part one that talks about race and people being different, race and Volk being different, being not the same. And she wanted to repeat that here because this is her main theme about this speech. This is what she wants to make it all about, that Hitler was recognizing that race, the race and the German people are not the same because the German people are not a race. That's what she's trying to get at. But actually, she changed this passage from the entire meaning of it, because the meaning people and people, or Volk und Volk, was saying that there's different kinds of people. You know, there's the people in the communist nation or some other kind of a nation where the people are just a mass of poor folk living in poverty and raised to blind obedience, which is what people want to say happened in Germany, but it didn't, who follow. But the people that he wants are people who look healthy and people who present an image of healthiness and so on. So all of that is that you have to wonder how that could have happened, how she could put race there. And that ties in my mind, with the fact that in the Hitler Himmler book, in her foreword, she's got the translation from Wilhelm Schmidt's book, Race und Volk. And whatever he's saying there, which is, I have never read the whole thing, but whatever he's saying, she wants to tie that in with what she's, with this speech, which probably doesn't really work out too well. And having is still here, so it's back on again. So I'll bring him on and see if I continue with this, if he has any comment to make on this. Just before adding, I just got a little bit more to add here. That in Carlos Porter's translation, after people and people are not the same, he says, I can imagine, where is that? I can imagine a people with a thin ruling class. But Veronica Clark changes it to, I can imagine a nation with a small upper class. Whereas people is not necessarily, nation is not the best translation for for people, because the word is still that's used in the German is still Volk. Volk and Volk are not the same, and then still I can imagine a Volk with the small upper class. And yet, in the one place she changes it to race, and the other she changes it to make it out to be nation. And I think that she's trying to change the meaning here. What would you say about that?
Well, there's a certain amount of ambiguity in translation. Some of the words don't exactly correspond to just one English word. You used some racial terms earlier. You said Eastern race. The usual rendering of that would be Alpine. The Eastern race, what they call Eastern in German, is usually called Alpine in English. And well, if there's a reference to Western race, that would be Mediterranean.
Well, I know you've said this before. You're probably not the best person for me to discuss this with, since I've got my own ideas about it. But anyway,
on this particular question of folk, it's not completely outrageous to translate folk as nation.
I know. I looked it up and I saw that it's a word, but it's very much less used that way. And the best is people and a couple other words, and nation is down as a choice further down. So I don't see why.
People, I prefer people as a translation for folk, but sometimes you run into situations where that will cause confusion because people in English is also the plural of person, right? So sometimes you might want to use the word nation to avoid that confusion.
If you say here, it's clear nevertheless, race and people are not the same. I can imagine a people with a small upper class. How is that going to cause confusion? There's no confusion there. You're just speaking theoretically.
Yeah, you're right.
In this case,
you're right.
You would just say people because you've already said people. And you're talking about that same people. So there's no reason to change it to nation unless you think you want to use a different word all the time.
That's right, yeah.
But what about the race in people when the German is Volk und Volk?
Well, I mean, that's obviously she probably thought there was a misprint or something, because she had her own ideas about what it was going to say, and it didn't fit, so she changed it.
Well, you've got a copy of that, German.
I don't know where to look in it, though.
Well, it's on page 48. And it's very, very clear. Some parts of that's a very bad copy. It's a bad copy from the Institute in Munich. But some pages are kind of bad and some things are hard to read. If you know German, you can figure it out. But if you don't know German that well, or not very well at all like me, unless it's a word I'm familiar with, I say, well, wait a minute, because there's parts, things that go up like in a D or so, those kind of things can be missing. But there's no way that she could not see this. So this is just an out-and-out switch around, which fits in with the fraudulence of using that Adolf Hitler quote, so supposed Adolf Hitler quote in the foreword that's not an Adolf Hitler quote. And I think that's truly outrageous. I don't know if you're off looking for something or if you're still here.
I'm looking here and I'm listening to you at the same time.
Yeah. Now let's see what's left in here. We can go back to that. Well, he talks
He says, aber eins war ja doch nun klar. Volk und Volk ist nicht dasselbe.
Right.
Volk and Volk is not the same thing. So,
right.
I mean, there's no ambiguity there. And can't, yeah.
And it's very clear, too. It's easy to read. There's no messing up in the text, I mean, there's no bad copy marks on it or anything. So it's very easy to see.
Whoever typed this up, they put quotation marks around folk both times. So that tells you also.
Right. That's why the quotation marks is there, because it's people both times. And so, you say, oh, well, there's a people and there's people, two different kinds of people. So that's very clear. And yet the quotation marks are around race and around people in Clark's translation. She's got the quotation marks there, but she changed that from to saying people and people to saying race and people. And the only reason I can think is that this is her argument, and that she's that's why also she put that. I don't think she put the whole thing, but whatever Wilhelm Schmidt wrote about race and people, or Rasse und Volk, in her foreword. She's trying to make a case here. The point I'm trying to make here, then, is that she's trying to make a case that is wrong and that distorts this whole speech that she calls a speech into some new kind of a thing. We've been through this before, some new kind of a thing that Hitler came up with, which shows that he didn't believe in race anymore. And there's just no truth to it whatsoever. And it really does burn me up when I knew it, and I knew it, and you knew it right from the start. But now with this translation, with getting the transcript from the Institute, and then I had to wait for Carlos to do the translation before I could know what it was saying. I didn't know where to look, and I just happened to notice this as I was going through it. And this is the kind of thing that you have to say, that this woman is not an honest scholar. She's not a scholar anyway, but she's not an honest scholar, that people think she's a scholar. What kind of bothers me is that a lot of people won't care anyway. They don't even care about something like that. They'll even say, oh, well, so what? You know, it's just a small thing. It's not small. It's not a small thing. So I don't know if you would call it what I call it, but... I mean, just so many people, you know, do it, but they're scummy people.
Well,
why is that's your phone that keeps ringing? I think that's this jerk that calls me. It's my phone, and it keeps ringing because he keeps dialing the phone. Boy, I never answer him, but he gets. I'm going to call the police on him. Okay, well, that's another issue. Except I don't know where he is or where he's calling from, but. All right. So any other comments you have on this?
No, that was really it. Yeah, you're right. You got her there. She's she has altered what Hitler said to fit her assumptions or her agenda, and didn't make any note of it either, did she?
No, that's right. She could have made note of it. That's what you're supposed to do. That's what footnotes are for. And yes, you see, and you're right. The thing is, you have to see the original copy to be able to tell, to be able to say that, don't you? Once you saw you looked at the original, you saw that. Oh, yeah, this is just clear as a bell, and you can't possibly get confused about it or think differently about it. Here's another little point on page 52, where Hitler is speaking of the Jews, and he says, he talks about, if I draw the hatred of the Jews upon me, then I would at least like to derive some benefit from that hatred. This is about at the top of the page 52, close to it. And the officers shout, quite correct. And then Hitler says, the advantage is that we now possess a cleanly organized body of the people in which no outsider can any longer just talk his way in. And you know, he's been talking about the Jews up until now quite a bit. It's all about the Germans and the Jews. And now he uses the word cleanly organized body of the people. And Carlos Porter translates it that way. And Carlos Porter was as I already wrote, that I asked him to just translate it pretty much straight, you know, the way Hitler said things, not try to make it sound better or nicer by picking out different words or whatever. So he's, you know, that's why I'm finding that he did do that, and his translation is more reliable. But Veronica changed that to, our advantage is that we now have a well-organized society and no outsiders can lecture us. I thought that was interesting because, you know, she didn't use the word cleanly organized. She just said well-organized, which doesn't have anything to do with Jews or other races. She's not...
Which German page is that again?
52, up at the top. The enemy knows that they can only hit women and children. He's talking about the
Okay.
Yeah, he's talking about the Hamburg bombings. And then acting humanely. And then the third paragraph, I guess, the advantage is that we now possess a cleanly organized body. And she says, well-organized society. And he, Carlos Porter, said, translated, in which no outsider can any longer just talk his way in. See, showing that Hitler sees people as being outsiders. And she translated that as no outsiders can lecture us. That's not the same thing. Now, what I don't know what you have there and what you would say about it in German, because I didn't check that out on Google Translate. But, you know, I say that Hitler's implying a German-only state, and that's what she doesn't want. She wants to think Hitler was open to others other than Germans in Germany. But he never said that. He never was, in my opinion. And I think that's correct. Nobody can show that. I think she toned that down, too. How would you translate it?
Well, you're talking about
the advantage.
Where it says, you know, I was just like looking through this, trying to get oriented. The passage is, he's talking about the barbarity of the Allies, which he says is due to the Jewish influence. And he mentions that they lost 40,000 women and children in Hamburg in one night.
Right.
From this Allied bombing.
But then he says right before that, if I draw the hatred of the Jews upon me, you know, he said acting humanely, he's not acting humanely enough toward the Jews, according to some people. But if I act humanely under such circumstances, it would be the greatest cruelty toward our own people. And then he says, if I draw the hatred of the Jews upon me, I would at least like to derive some benefit from that hatred. And then he says that the advantage they now have is a cleanly organized body of the people. Which, what did they get out of? How did they clean up the people? They got rid of the Jews. That's how. And no outsider can any longer just talk his way in, whatever that means. But it doesn't necessarily mean no outsiders can lecture us. It means nobody can get in who is not one of us.
Yeah, I actually can't find what you're talking about, but I'll take your word.
you can't find a sentence that says the advantage is that we now possess, or our advantage is that we now have.
No, not at the top of 52. I can't find it, no.
Well, I said it's the third paragraph down.
Oh, way down at the bottom. Oh, okay, now
no.
I see it, yes.
Oh, it's already, it is close to the bottom. You're right. These pages don't have much on them.
Yeah, okay. Okay, somebody in parentheses says, sehr richtig, very correct.
Let's see.
Der Vorteil besteht darin, the advantage consists in that we possess a cleanly, the word is sauber, cleanly, it is cleanly, yes.
Well,
cleanly
that's
organized.
What, and that's what Carlos Porter used. Exactly right. Cleanly organized. Yeah.
Like if you clean your house, that's sauber machen, right?
Wow. That's really close, isn't it? Now, why didn't Veronica Clark use the word cleanly? She said she used well organized. Well.
Yeah. Well is a very vague term. Sauber
right.
is much more.
That's right. That's not translated properly either. You know, I thought it seemed like a good when I got that one, I thought it was good, but now that I have Carlos Porter's and I compare the two of them, which I've done as I've gone through it all, I would say Carlos Porter's is very superior to the other one, because the other one is trying too often to just make it easy to read or something. And it is a little more vague. So it should be cleanly. And what about the rest of the sentence, in which no outsider can any longer just talk his way in?
Yeah, into which no other any longer can talk his way in, right?
Oh,
yeah. In other words,
that's exactly right.
Hmm? Yeah. Did the light just go on for you?
Yeah, because then the way Veronica's book has got it translated, it's just not translated properly at all. Because it's very clear to you. That it's the same thing as what Carlos came up with. It's not about outsiders can lecture us. It's that no outsiders can get their way in, can find their way in, or talk their way in.
Yeah, hinein is like on in, right? Talking their way in. Talk, can no longer talk their way in. That would be
what he says. That's exactly what he says. Well, this is great because this has helped me even more to see that you can't depend on Veronica Clark for quality or for correctness.
I know, and you trusted her so much until today.
What? I didn't hear that. Maybe others didn't hear it either. Say it again.
I said, and your faith is shattered because you trusted her until now.
Yeah, well, I didn't, but, you know, it's I felt I wanted to talk about this speech since I've got it on my website now in a different translation, and comparing the translations is important, and finding the failings of hers is really important. It's not just realizing
that. Well, it's more than failings. She just went out and flat out changed things.
Yeah. Thanks for saying that.
Misrepresented.
That's right.
Adolf Hitler.
That's what she's doing.
We don't have enough people misrepresenting Adolf Hitler. Don't need more.
No, we don't need people who say they're on his side and they're great great friends of Adolf Hitler also misrepresenting him, which in a way that's worse than the people who are just, you know, that they are doing it. Well, there's a lot of more interesting things here, but I think he says, here we are at the end of the show, 90 seconds. And, you know, at the end, Goring, I'm going to go over a little bit. At the end, Goring gives his little talk, and I can see now that the things he says, he was again addressing so many of these officers who were not 100% on board with their Führer. We know that they were not. He was aware of it too, and he says in his kind of tribute to Hitler after his speech was over, his talk was over. He says, I was able to throw off my baggage early. He thanks his creator that he was able to throw off his baggage early. Baggage which many of you gentlemen have had to carry much longer and into recent years right down to today. And he says, you would experience a great feeling of relief if you could throw off all this old rubbish from yesteryear, which prevents us from seeing clearly in many areas, and enter the new and beautiful all the more easily. We must clear our minds, precisely we officers, we must find our way to these ideals, new ideals, gentlemen. We wish to say once openly, and it means a lot to me to say, when we were being educated as cadets or young lieutenants, the monarchy still existed, and as the Führer correctly said, it was a matter of course for the entire officer corps to be monarchist, and so on. And so what he's implying is that now that the state is National Socialist, not monarchist or anything else, it's National Socialist, and it would be a matter of course for the entire officer corps to be National Socialist and to follow that. And that's what he's encouraging, and he ends up saying I believe there is no prouder feeling for an officer than in this hour to crowd around this man and experience the happy feeling to stand by his side to the last. So he's giving a big plug for that, but I think that's what it's telling us, that Hitler doesn't have the loyalty from everybody that he should have. They all, though, applaud that and show stormy demonstrations of applaud for the Führer at the end. Well, how important do you think this talk or so-called speech to the officers and generals is having?
Well, I think it's interesting that it confirms that Hitler's racial views basically had not changed. You know, basically still saying the same thing that you can read in the party's materials from 1933.
Right. And, you know, what is significant about it is that it gives us a clear picture of what Hitler believed and what he thought. Well, it's not the only clear picture, so that's why it's not the most significant at all. But it's very useful and interesting because it tells us a lot about Hitler and reinforces so many things and makes, you know, it becomes very clear what he did believe. So there we go. I don't know what to say about this woman. I don't know if she's still, what she's doing today. You haven't heard much from her.
I expect but, she'll be back.
Yeah, she might be back because of this show, but it really irks me that people do these kind of things and get away with it as much as they do. And so many people in our movement that other people look up to are just taken in by it and don't.
Yeah, especially
not
elderly
able.
Men.
Yeah. But I also mentioned John Friend, who's been totally taken in by it, and all kinds of people who say, oh, I like her work or whatever. But what she did do a lot of damage to herself with some of her anti-white nationalist talk, but and the bizarre things that she does. And I want to point out at the end here, because so I have a way to do it so it won't just sound tacky and nasty, but on the you know, on her Amazon page, she's got a picture of herself as a very young woman. She's finally put up this picture, and I've got it on the Blog Talk slideshow for this program. And there's something about her that even though she looks like she you think, well, this is a pretty young woman, there's something wrong, and I've determined that it's her jaw. She has too big of a jaw. She has a kind of a big, wide jaw, and that's what takes away from her looking like a pretty vulnerable young thing. But on the other thing I notice is that she's got these, she's wearing lots of black eye makeup, and she always does that. In everything you see of her, you don't see too many pictures of her, but she loves this very dark black makeup. But you can see that maybe she's trying to make herself into some kind of a character now. But at that time, she was just a young woman who was probably told that she was pretty and attractive, whatever, and is wanting to be. But that she chose to wear, you can just see it. It just looks like it's just globbed onto her eyelashes and around her eyes, thick black stuff. And this is typical, or this is something you find in women, young women who are kind of insecure and are trying to be thought very attractive, trying to use their looks to cover up, you know, or to get somewhere with their looks. It's not German. She looks Polish. She does look Polish, but it's not a German thing. German women don't use a lot of makeup in generally, even today, unless, you know, a few exceptions or something, but. And particularly around the eyes, that's a different kind of a people that does that. Talk what I was, why I brought that up. Now, why did I? I had my justification for that all set in my mind. That she's, oh, yeah, well, I thought that she did that. She used all that eye makeup in order to draw attention to her eyes and take attention away from her jaw, which is her worst feature. And she's gotten carried away with that anyway. But then all these male transvestite singers that she likes, they all put a lot of eye black around their eyes too. So that's why I think she does it still today. Because there was a pretty more recent photograph of her on when she was had the interview at Red Ice Creations Radio. And she had a lot of black around her eyes in that picture too. Well, there we go. What can I say? I'm having a hard time with this program, opening it up and closing it down too. So, Hadding, I want to thank you for coming on with me, and I guess I've said everything I have to say. You have any last word before we say goodnight to the folks?
Yeah, watch out. Watch out for the frauds.
Yeah. Well, really, it takes people like us to stay awake and show where it's coming from. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this has been Heretics Hour on February 16th, 2015. Thanks for listening.